Hello, I'm Caleb Howard, and this is Tales from Sacred Texts.
The world is built on stories. From the beginning of time, humans have immersed themselves in legends and myth. When God himself wanted to explain to us what he was like, he didn't push elaborate treatises, but instead told stories about humanity. In this podcast, I tackle the concept of religion through stories and legends. Told through a 21st century lens, I explain to religious and non-religious people alike the stories that lie at the very heart of the belief that maybe there is a God, and maybe he really is good. This week's story is on Daniel. In one of our very first episodes of this podcast, we talked about the apocryphal portion of Daniel, one that credited him with inventing cross-examination and basic detective work. While those stories were interesting, the writing style, motivations, and character dynamics were nothing like the Protestant version of Daniel. So we're basically starting an entirely new story. For a little context about the meaning of Daniel, Daniel is one of the key prophetic books. In the book of Daniel, the titular character predicts world history up through the fall of Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. The grandfather of one of my college professors was drafted into the Nazi army and spent his time, among other things, bravely sabotaging the German effort to exterminate the Jews. One of the things he did was convince his commanders to hold their resources in reserve because the Book of Daniel predicted the defeat of the Nazi regime. Interesting stuff, and I'll do a supplemental on Daniel's prophecies sometime. What's important for today is that Daniel is written in a chiastic structure. Basically, that means it parallels stories with similar themes. Chapters 2 and 7 are similar predictions outlining the movements of global powers until Jesus is coming. Chapters 3 and 6 are stories about persecution and God's triumph over the threats of powerful tyrants. But today's episode will focus on chapters 4 and 5, the stories of two powerful kings who let pride and self-obsession take control of them. And the contrast, how one saw his mistakes and changed his ways, while the other's arrogance led to, well, we'll have to hold that thought until we get there. The king's names are Nebuchadnezzar and Belteshazzar, but those are mouthfuls, and I don't want to be saying them like 10 times in a sentence. So if it's all right with y'all, I'll be calling them King Neb and King Bel, respectively. Just a very quick bit of backstory. The Neo-Babylonian Empire had been menacing the small Jewish kingdom of Judah for years. Judah had become entangled in a web of tradition and formalism that elevated rich leaders at the cost of moving God to the back burner. As such, God did not work the miracles of old to save the Jewish people. Gone were the days of God wiping out entire armies and parting major bodies of water for his people to walk across. But the Jewish people still carried the arrogance that came with the assumption that God was on their side no matter what. They began prodding the Babylonian Empire, which quickly came to put their little kingdom, barely a kingdom, more of a city-state, in its place. King Neb ended up raiding Jerusalem, killing the leading families, and kidnapping their sons to take to his capital, Babylon, to be indoctrinated and eventually sent back to rule as puppets. In this raid, Neb took Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah back to Babylon and renamed them as Belteshazzar, not to be confused with the King Bel we'll meet later, so we'll call him Daniel still, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Things are pretty rough from the very beginning, with the king trying to feed the four young men non-kosher food and basically receiving a hard no. The four ended up convincing the king's servant to feed them only vegetables, after which the boys looked so healthy that they were allowed to eat whatever they wanted. A couple years passed, and the Jewish young men were trained up to become astrologers and to practice divination, which was great and all until King Neb had a dream and couldn't remember what it was. The senior diviners couldn't provide a satisfactory answer, and so the king threatened to chop every single one of them, including the students, up into pieces and make their homes a rubbish heap. One of these is much worse than the other. Daniel found out about the whole thing, ran into the king's room, offered to tell the king what the dream was, and offer a prophetic interpretation. Despite the interpretation being the very politically incorrect statement that King Neb's dream of a statue made up of various metals predicted that the Neo-Babylonian Empire would soon be overthrown, it apparently satisfied the king for a few weeks. After the initial shock, the king built a statue like the one in his dream, except for the fact that it was only made out of one metal, to show that the Neo-Babylonian Empire would last forever. The king, obviously took the next step and tried to make everybody worship it. We'll actually do a full episode on this part of the story, but basically Daniel was elsewhere, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego decide not to worship the statue. The king tried to kill them and failed, and so then King Neb decided that he would chop anyone who did not worship Yahweh to pieces and make their houses an ash heap. King Neb didn't really understand the nuance that worshiping Yahweh was an individual choice and that forced worship was really no worship at all. Because while Neb acknowledged the power of Yahweh, he continued to prioritize himself and his own pride. And that's how the story starts. You know when you look out from a high vantage point onto the surrounding city or countryside beneath you? Seeing people as small as ants, miniature cars racing about their business, oblivious to you far above them. All of that, and you're filled with awe? Well, King Neb had that too. His logical response was to proclaim loudly, "I am a god." Daniel, standing behind him, laughed a bit. Neb turned around, affronted. "What?" Daniel chuckled. That was a bit much. Neb knew he wasn't a god, and really, it just looked goofy seeing him check his reflection out and square his shoulders and strut around. Neb hadn't known Daniel was watching, and he was mildly embarrassed, but mostly proud. He had built all of this. He had raised this town up from sandy desert to be literally one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. He had conquered the then-known world. He was all-powerful, undefeated, legendary. All because Yahweh had empowered him to do it, Daniel reminded. King Neb scoffed. Religious people, am I right? But he couldn't get what Daniel had said out of his head. And when he dreamed that night, he dreamed a horrifying dream. In it, an enormous tree stood, a refuge for birds and animals of all kinds, growing delicious fruit that kept all the creatures satisfied. But then an angel came from the clear blue sky like a bolt of lightning, carrying with him an axe and in an authoritative voice, passing some sort of sentence on the tree. Neb couldn't help but hear the cold and chilling words dooming the tree to destruction. Then the angel raised the axe. For some reason, King Neb felt a chill when the angel raised his axe and in a single blow felled the tree. The birds and animals fled the scene in terror, and Neb tried, but he was rooted to the spot. The angel took a chain of iron and bronze and bound the tree's stump so that it could not regrow. The angel then looked directly at Neb and spoke the chilling words, "The Holy Ones have declared a verdict. Let him be drenched with the dew of heaven, and let him live with the animals. Let his mind be changed from that of a man, and let him be given the mind of an animal until 7 years pass by." Then the angel, his mission accomplished, fled through the rapidly gathering dark clouds and disappeared. Neb, disturbed, called Daniel. What did this mean? Well, sort of. He called Daniel, but by his Babylonian name. The name that he, Neb, had given him. He had named Daniel after his favorite god. When Daniel walked in, Neb praised the Babylonian gods. He's got the spirit of all the gods in him. He slapped an advisor on the back. Daniel rolled his eyes. Again. They'd been over this. There was no god but Yahweh, and Daniel was just a spokesman for Yahweh. He did not know Neb's gods. They had given him no help in the matter. "Enough," Neb interrupted. "It's my gods who are helping you. End of story. Now spit out the interpretation." Well then, why hadn't Neb called the literal hordes of men who claimed to speak for his gods? Neb sighed. He had. He'd called them all, and none of them could ever understand the dream. These guys had a bad track record. Did the Book of Daniel ever record a single time when they were competent? And perhaps the fact that they claimed to speak for one set of gods and were powerless, while Daniel claimed to speak for the Hebrew God and be powerful, perhaps that should just clue the king into the fact that maybe, just maybe, the set of gods he was worshiping was the wrong one. Nope. My gods are the right ones, your gods are wrong, now tell me the interpretation. Neb began to tell the dream to Daniel, sort of in that voice where you're just not sure of yourself and just kind of stumbling over the words, and Daniel's mouth dropped lower and lower and lower until it was hanging open and the Hebrew was pacing the room. Wow, wow, wow. That was dark. That bad, huh? Well, Neb wouldn't kill Daniel or hold it against him if it was a bad interpretation. He needed to know. Please, just tell him. If it was bad news, he wanted it out right now instead of living through the terror of not knowing. Well, it was bad. Like, think about the worst thing you could think of, and it was 10 times worse. Daniel warned the king, this was not going to be good. Neb started to shake. Was he going to die? Neb thought that this was the obvious worst meaning. Daniel shook his head. Worse, Neb was going to be humiliated. He was going to go insane and basically become an animal. They would drive him out of the palace with spears and weapons, and he'd rove around the countryside like a cow or pig. He'd eat grass and plants and be exposed to the elements. This would last 7 years. Now it was the king's mouth hanging open. Daniel quickly took advantage of his silence to add an admonishment. Here was his 2 cents. Stop saying you're a god, stop going around oppressing people, which is literally what you're notorious for, and start trying to live better. Your hubris is causing your people to suffer tremendously, and God clearly wants that to stop. If you change your ways, maybe God will see no need to teach you such a drastic lesson. I'm reminded of the story of Prince Rabadash from the Chronicles of Narnia series, and I'm pretty sure that C.S. Lewis was heavily inspired by this story. In the story, Rabadash has created a brutal, violent, desperate plot to kidnap a wife, and has failed. He is threatened with magical punishment, but continues to persist in his foolishness. He is warned that his, quote, doom is very near, but you can still avoid it, end quote. He persists further and is warned that the doom is, quote, nearer now. It is at the door. It has lifted the latch. End quote. Neb was given the same pattern of warnings and chances. Perhaps he made some effort to reform, but a year later, Neb was walking along the palace roof, again proclaiming loudly, I am a god. He shouted and cursed at his servants for failing to follow his latest bizarre order exactly. He continued, saying that he didn't need Daniel's god. He had done it all himself. In that instant, Neb heard a voice booming from heaven, announcing the doom that he had brought on himself. Just as the lion spoke to Prince Rabadash, so God spoke to Neb. The hour has struck. In his fleeting moments of sanity, Neb realized that he was completely powerless without God. All that he had done was through the talents God had given him. He should have shown kindness and respect to his subjects, as fellow children of God, rather than being merciless and capricious, using his favorite punishment of cutting them in pieces and disregarding their cries of suffering. But it was only an instant, and then his only thoughts were simple. Where could he get more grass to eat? Exactly 7 years later, Neb looked up. What had happened? He had awoken in a field, naked and covered in dew. His fingernails were like long claws, and his hair was long and matted. He remembered this past 7 years, but as it were a dream. He stumbled to the nearest house, where the owners gasped and ran in terror. He was finally able to get himself cleaned up. As the rumors reached the palace, the nobles sought Neb out. The kingdom was in disarray, and Neb had been such a great ruler in his time. Could he come back and fix things? Neb nodded. He could, but his talents were only his thanks to Yahweh. He would be paying his homage first to God, and when he ruled again, he would be different. He would be better. The last few years of Neb's reign were some of his best. His kingdom was at peace, and he continued to improve what was already one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Neb continued to serve Yahweh. Shortly before his death, he wrote an account that is preserved in Daniel chapter 4, making Neb the only world ruler whose praise of God is recorded in Scripture. Neb praised Yahweh for the lesson he learned. Others could choose how they wished. There would be no cutting in pieces of those who chose to still worship the old gods, but as for him, he had chosen Yahweh. The kingdom of Babylon goes downhill fast after Neb's death, but that will be right after this. The past 23 years had been marked by some mid-level strife within the kingdom. Not extreme stuff, but a child king did get beaten to death, another ruler got killed, and a foreigner took charge of government, bringing with him his foreign gods. The foreigner was a straight-up madman, and he eventually abandoned the kingdom for 10 years, leaving his pleasure-loving and inane son in charge. His son, named Bel, did stupid and self-destructive things. As a result, he became unpopular not only with the people, but also the rest of the ruling class. By the winter of 540 BC, the kingdom of Babylon was in significant conflict with an alliance between the Median and Persian empires. Sometime during the year of 539 BC, remember the years go backwards, the coalition invaded Babylon. Yet Bel's first thought was to throw the biggest party ever. While the Persian coalition surrounded the city, Bel's rager began. The city was impregnable. The walls were thick. A river ran through the city to provide them with fresh water, but there were heavily reinforced grates there that prevented anyone from getting in. Soldiers stood guard 24/7. But while the strength of the city put Bel's mind at ease, he really wasn't thinking about those fortifications tonight. King Bel downed another glass of wine. This was a good time. And you know what would make it even better? By drinking out of the holy vessels of the Hebrews god. Bel wanted to flex his power. He had beaten the Hebrews god, and thus he would beat the Persians god as well. He actually didn't know they might have been the same god. He really wasn't an expert on religions, but they seemed fairly similar. I mean, we know that they aren't the same god, but to a Babylonian, they may have seemed really similar, which may have affected Bel's decision to bring out the Hebrew vessels right then and there. Regardless, that was Bel's demand. The vessels were going to come out now. The servants questioned Bel if he was sure about this. The Hebrews god had done some weird stuff when Neb was king a few years ago. The guy had turned into an animal for 7 years, and some guys he'd thrown into a fire came walking right back out. Weird stuff. Did he want to give the middle finger to that god? Drunk, Bel slurred his words. Yes, yes he did. Those, and quote, miracles? Mere accidents. That god? Powerless to help his people. If Bel had been sober, maybe he would have made a different decision. But Bel was not sober. His main thought was that it would be quite fun to insult the Hebrews god, and he firmly ordered his servants to go. Get the holy vessels. Pronto. He passed them around to his servants, slurring about the at best powerless, at worst imaginary Hebrew god that had let his kingdom take all of his holy vessels. He laughed. This was very funny. He poured some wine into the vessel in his hand, splashing it on the table. He roared the ancient Babylonian equivalent of cheers and raised the glass to his mouth. But the moment that it touched his lips, the room shook and darkened. Silence fell as a disembodied hand appeared,
writing 4 words in fiery red ink on the wall. Bell's face turned pale and he lost control of his bladder. He was a shivering mess as he watched the hand emblazon the words, the fiery pin showing up brilliantly in the low light. Meanie. Meanie. Tekel. Eupharson. The king shouted for his wise men, and they rushed in, but they were equally terrified. The furthest they could get was it meant numbered, weighed, and well, the last one had several meanings, but it could mean divided, Persians, or slang for half a coin. Those were very different things. Bell sagged to the ground, hopeless. The words of doom still burned across the wall, but there was no one to help him. Not one word of comfort in all the drunken crowd. That was until the queen rushed into the room. Daniel. Daniel could do it. Daniel's skills were legendary. He could interpret the dream. It took a lot longer than the king expected. Daniel, now an elderly man, moved slowly, but he finally shuffled into the room after being awoken late at night. Daniel rubbed his eyes. Surely this must be urgent. King Bell breathed slightly easier. It was. What did these words mean? His voice shook with every word. Did Daniel want to be a powerful ruler? He had only to interpret these words and he would be clothed in gold and purple and given power over the kingdom subservient only to the king. Daniel ignored the inducements and spoke in a slow but sad voice. Bell knew of the story of Neb. He knew, if he had not witnessed firsthand, how Neb had been punished with insanity after he had insulted God and impressed his people. It had been so obvious, so painfully obvious, what the right thing to do was. Bell had the benefit of seeing the mistakes of his predecessors, but he didn't change. He didn't take any of it to heart, but instead went even further than they had in wrongdoing. Now, Daniel would explain the words. Meanie. It meant numbered. God had numbered the days of Bel's kingdom, and his time was up. Tekel. Weighed. King Bel had been weighed, and he had been found by God to be lacking. Eupharson was a play on a word that means both divided in Persians. Your kingdom has been divided and given to the Persian coalition. Bell's face sagged, but he did keep his promises. He reached for a gold chain and placed it around Daniel's neck. He wrapped a purple robe around Daniel. All of this as if to say, if the Persians came in, they'd identify Daniel as royalty and kill him too. Daniel shook his head. It wasn't his time yet, but it was Bell's. Outside the hall, the partiers heard for the first time shouting and clashing of swords. See, the Persian general, Cyrus, had been working on diverting the river for some time. Preoccupied with the party, the king and generals weren't aware that tonight he'd finally succeeded in that supposedly impossible task. The Persian soldiers dropped into the riverbed and marched up to the gates that allowed the river to pass through the city, but those gates had either been foolishly left unlocked or, meant to withstand small groups of soldiers in boats, were quickly broken through by a large frontal assault from hundreds of men marching in the dry riverbed. It was late at night and most people were preoccupied with the party. The soldiers had thus marched into the city, facing barely any resistance. They had been informed by spies of the exact location of the king, and they marched directly there. The doors to the banquet hall crashed open as the Persians marched in, ignoring the legendary Daniel, whom the spies had informed them was merely a captive Jew with no loyalty to the Babylonians.
The Persians had no intention of slaughtering the entire city, but merely viewed themselves as grand liberators, saving the population from a tyrannical ruler. They stepped up to King Bel and cut him down with their swords, killing some of the influential nobles who spoke out. The Persian general, Cyrus, took some of the others prisoner, but he quickly assured the population that his only quarrel was with the capricious and unpopular Bel. He would allow the city to choose their own gods, to live their own way, but they must acknowledge his authority. Bel had been no favorite, and the population quickly agreed to the invading army's terms. They were in no mood to be cut down like their king. That night, the Neo-Babylonian Empire fell, and the Persian Empire took its place, just like Isaiah had predicted over 150 years earlier, even mentioning Cyrus by name. King Bel's end was sad, and it stands in sharp contrast to King Neb's. Neb was able to see his own mistakes and to grow. He was able to reject pride, arrogance, and a desire for dominance over others and to lead his people in a better way. But Bel, despite knowing so much about the end result of pride and the power of Yahweh, rejected the opportunity to do the right thing and instead went out of his way to insult the god of his predecessor. Again and again, the Bible emphasizes how one's choices make or break their future. Opportunities are given again and again to everyone, but what they do with those opportunities defines them. Will people choose God and live their life in the way He asks, letting God take the evil desires from them and make them better? Or will they let those desires rule them until it is too late? Jesus was teaching when he compared himself to the cornerstone at a foundation of a building. Whoever falls upon this stone will be broken to pieces, but anyone on whom it falls will be crushed. Those who throw themselves on the mercy of Jesus, surrendering their pride and selfish desires, will be broken. They will be sorrowful for the things they have done, and they will endure the pain of change and growth. They will be remade into a better person with new desires, though the process is painful. But those who run from Jesus, preferring to live their own way full of pride and selfishness, will be crushed by the natural consequences of their actions and by God's judgment. This will be painful too, but there will be no change or growth. Instead, they will be crushed by despair. Those who flee from Jesus will be left hurting and hopeless. The last thing I want to touch on, very briefly, is something I spoke on last time. Achievements. Neb and Bel both viewed their accomplishments as something they manufactured themselves. Neb was clear. He had not asked God for help. Christians sometimes seem to credit God for the stupidest accidents or things they did obviously under their own power. Sometimes it seems a bit naive for them to praise God for everything. But Daniel explains why they praise God when the book explains that all those things Neb did under his own power, he did them through the talents God had given him. No, the talents he was born with, Neb argued. Luck of the draw, and he had taken advantage of it. God responded clearly. Those talents were God's, to give or take away at any moment. Every talent that Neb used was on loan from God himself and could be revoked at any time. Everything Neb did was only because God gave him the ability to. That's why we should thank God. All of our talents and abilities, those are all given by Him. The accomplishments we make, it's God that enables us to make them. The abilities that we are given are God's, and we should use them to help Him accomplish His mission of restoring human dignity and happiness rather than to benefit ourselves. To quote the Bible, "The Lord God has told us what is right and what He demands. See that justice is done, let mercy be your first concern, and humbly obey your God." All of our ability should be poured into these goals, because that's what God gave them to us for. The gospel is this. Humans have become evil and twisted through millennia of selfishness. But Jesus saw in us something that no one else saw, that we didn't have to stay that way. He left us on earth with only one mission, to help him rehabilitate humanity and prepare as many as possible for never-ending happiness and selflessness. That mission is what our abilities should be used for. That's all for this week. Next time, we'll be doing a wild story about Balaam, and we'll learn what happens when you get the once-in-the-history-of-the-world chance to talk to your pet, and you pick the literal worst thing to tell them. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. The higher the listen stats go, the more encouraged I am. I love the subject matter that I talk about, and I can't wait to produce more content for y'all. One big thing you can do is tell your friends all about this podcast and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Again, thank you so much for choosing to spend your time with me. Credits to myself, Caleb Howard, for theme music and script writing. Credits to the amazing artists of Open Source Music and Evoke Music for the accompanying music, and I'll see you next time.